We call it domestic violence. We call it private violence. Sometimes we call it intimate terrorism. But whatever we call it, we generally do not believe it has anything at all to do with us, despite the World Health Organization deeming it a global epidemic. In America, domestic violence accounts for 15% of all violent crime, and yet it remains locked in silence even as its tendrils reach unseen into so many of our most pressing national issues, from our economy to our education system, from mass shootings to mass incarceration to Me Too. In her new book, No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us, award-winning journalist Rachel Louise Snyder gives context for what we don't know we're seeing. Rachel Louise Snyder's work has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, The Washington Post, and she is an associate professor at American University. Again, the name of the new book is No Visible Bruises, and we welcome Rachel to the roundtable this morning. Rachel, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What brought you to the subject to want to investigate this?
Well, that's kind of an interesting story. I spent 2 decades sort of out in the world covering stories of social issues, human rights, and domestic violence was always kind of adjacent to those issues, so much so that I'm kind of embarrassed to say I didn't even look at it. I just assumed it was everywhere, right? And all the child brides and the forced sterilization of the women killed for love crimes and things like that. So it wasn't really until I came back to the States and I was standing on the driveway of a dear old friend of mine who you might know, Andre Debuse III. He's a writer in the Boston area.
A good friend.
Yeah.
He's the best.
25 years I've known him, and his sister drove up. This was in maybe 2010. And I had never met her. Of course, I'd heard her name mentioned over the years. So he introduced me. Suzanne Debuse is her name. And, I did that American thing. Oh, what do you do? You know, I'm a writer, a professor. And she said, oh, you know, I work in domestic violence. And I thought, oh, sure, I know all about that. And I said, oh, yeah, what do you do? And she said, well, you know, I've just come up with a program to predict domestic violence homicide before it happens as a way to stop it and prevent it. And I was like, come again? What? And I ended up following her around that whole day. Like, she had errands to run. They were going on a family vacation, just asking her about it. And I was so taken with the idea, not only that someone like me, who I felt like I was somewhat savvy when it came to gendered issues and social issues and humanitarian issues, but also the idea that you could do something about it. It was, like, shocking to me. So I started researching.
One of the things that comes through in the book is that, I mean, this is one of those things that is so prevalent, and yet we haven't agreed even on what to call it, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm writing about that right now for The Atlantic, and in fact, I called a friend of mine recently, Deborah Tannen, who's a sociolinguist, and I said, what is the problem with this term? Why can't we come up with something better? And part of it is that when you tack the word, for me, when you tack the word domestic on, it just sublimates it. Like, it just makes it softer, right? Like, we domesticate our pets. And it relegates it to the world of home, which, as we all know, is the world of women. I mean, in some ways, wife beater, which was the old term we used to use, right, all through the 19th and early 20th century, is a much more apt description, although it leaves out entire populations, right? Children and same-sex partnerships and stuff, but it's a visual, and it's sort of more stunning. And Deborah and I sort of both agree that the word terrorism captures it more appropriately, but of course that word is weighted in a million other ways too. So I don't think we've really come up with the right term for it yet.
There is also that term private violence, and it's accurate, right? I mean, that's one of the problems, is that it is private. It is what happens behind that closed door.
Yeah, absolutely. It happens behind closed doors. It's even just beyond the fact that it happens behind closed doors. There's so much shame wrapped up in it, and it's so gendered. I mean, it's true that women beat men. It's true that there are same-sex relationships that have domestic violence, that parents beat children, that you know, children beat elders. I mean, all these constellations of it exist, but the overwhelming majority is men against women. And, I think society moves, and then policy moves at a much more slower pace than social progress.
you talk about, I mean, this is a big enough problem that the World Health Organization deemed it a global epidemic. To know that, to be able to deem it that, they must have a lot of information. So how do we get that information, and then how do we use that information to improve the problem?
I mean, part of the problem is that these numbers are, I mean, there's a Northeastern professor who just came out with new numbers. And for years in this country, in the States, we've said 3 women a day are killed by their intimate partners. Since 2017, that number is now 4. Now, you can look at that, you can divide that any way you want. You can say, well, that's not that much of an increase, it's only one person. Or you can say, oh my God, that's a 20% increase. That's shocking, right? So it depends on how you slice those numbers. To me, and what I was trying to do in the book was to get away a little bit from the numbers. You know, I do have that as a backdrop, that World Health Organization, you know, and there was a new report that said 50,000 women across the world in 2017 were killed by intimate partner violence. That's just a shocking number, but it's also completely abstract. So to me, what really resonates and what I was trying to do in the book is kind of take us away from those numbers and say, look, I met a woman who brought a rattlesnake home and just kept it in their house and said, if you disobey me, if you leave me, if you do anything, I'm going to put this rattlesnake in the shower with you. I'm going to put this rattlesnake in the bed with you.
Mm.
And that I think resonates more. You know, my background is in fiction. I studied fiction writing. I have an MFA in fiction. And so even though I've been a journalist for 20 years, in fact, apparently now I'm a veteran journalist, my brain works in novels. My brain works in stories. And so I started telling people that I knew nobody would want to read a book about domestic violence, so I just tried to write a book that you couldn't walk away from without finishing.
You write a lot about this, and it's a question that inevitably comes up, which is, why don't they just leave? It is the most common question, is, as you indicate in the book, that is asked. But it also shows how much is misunderstood about the problem, right?
Yeah, it is. My secret hope has become that question is outdated as a question, in the same way that, like, our language has progressed, you know, over the last couple of decades in other areas, issues of race and gender and things like that, that we no longer say wife beating, for example, so we'll no longer ask that question. So, you know, the snake is a good example of that. He didn't have to beat her at all to have control over her. And what he would do is, if she threatened to leave, if she went to the authorities, he would take their children and just leave. He would go camping and she wouldn't know where they were. So it makes you, I say this in the book, it makes you a passive hostage in your own home. It's coercion. It's why we say it's intimate partner terrorism. You don't actually have to beat anybody to have control over them. And people would say to her, you know, her mother-in-law would say, go to the domestic violence shelter. Go stay at my sister's house in Arizona. And she would say, how am I going to do that? He's going to follow me anywhere. I can't forever live in a shelter. I can't support my children in a shelter. If I go to your sister's house in Arizona, he can report me for kidnapping the children. How am I going to leave? How can I leave? And so, in some sense, we don't know the constellation of forces keeping someone in that situation. But in her case, she was actively leaving. Leaving is a process, not an event. So she had, for example, gotten a small inheritance from her grandfather and given it to her father and secretly purchased the house in a land contract that they were living in. So it was in her name only. Her husband didn't know that. So that way she could eventually get him out. Then, because he wouldn't let her work, she had started taking classes at the local college to try to get a nursing degree, right? But he would stalk her while she was taking her classes and make sure that she came home right after and that kind of thing. So she was putting things in place to be able to leave him, but it was going to take her years. And then he killed her, killed her kids, killed himself.
Rachel Louise Snyder is our guest. The name of the book is No Visible Bruises: What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. You write, there's so many words in this vocabulary of the subject that are loaded, and one of them that you write about is the word estranged.
Oh, yeah. Oh, get me down with the adjectives. I tell you, estranged is like toxic masculinity, right? Like, nothing inherently bad about masculinity, but you put that adjective on it and it changes the entire scenario. People say, why doesn't she just leave? And I say, go do a Google search for the word estranged and killed and wife. And you will find that is when people are killed, is when they try to leave. That is the most dangerous time. There's research that backs this, the research done by a woman at Johns Hopkins University, Jacqueline Campbell, who determined that the first 90 days after someone leaves an abusive relationship are the most dangerous for any victim, and the danger stays high for a year and then begins to fall off slowly after that. Not in all cases, certainly. It's research, so it's imperfect. But if we can build protections around victims based on those sort of timelines, the emotional intensity begins to drop off. But it is the most dangerous time to leave.
We can get into semantics, though, because the word estranged seems to indicate, at least often, and I'm coming at this from a journalist's point of view, that it can be two-sided. You know, the both are responsible for that estrangement, where, again, we need a better word, don't we? I mean, violent is violent, I guess.
Yeah, violent is violent. I mean, they're both abstract words. So if I'm Deborah Tannen and I'm a sociolinguist, I'm going to say they're both malleable.
Yeah.
I'm not 100% sure I'm following it. To me,
I guess it's the definition of estranged, of what we mean by that, that I worry about when we use that term, that we also mean that it is sort of even mutual, that, we don't know who was responsible for the estrangement.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think that's absolutely true. I mean, estranged suggests that there was agreement in the dissolution of whatever that partnership was, and probably there is not. Right. Like, she's trying to get away. She's
right.
Using all of her resources, and he's not allowing her. So, it's true. You're right. I mean, these words are the basis for all of our understanding, right? And so the term domestic violence, as we talked about a minute ago, is easy to sort of look away from because it suggests something that has nothing to do with us, a home that is not our home. And I never really thought about estranged in quite that way. That's so smart of you.
Well,
you should write a book.
Well, as I said, I'm coming from the journalistic, because it's a word that's bandied around. It's a way of describing a domestic situation, and it just doesn't seem like it can have perhaps more weight than it deserves.
Yeah, it's true. It does, and it relegates it to a certain partnership again that is not ours and not us. And so it's like, oh, what an unfortunate moment for that particular home or that family.
One of the fascinating things that you write about in the book is a huge percentage of women in prison today are there because they killed their abusers. What does that tell us about domestic violence programs in this country?
You know, that was so fascinating. I was sitting in on this talk by this researcher in, I think it was Michigan, I can't remember exactly now. And she said, I thought she had misspoken, actually. And she said, we know that when we look at our effect of domestic violence advocacy, we look at the numbers of homicides of men being reduced. And I was like, come again? What? No, that can't, she must mean women. And I asked her about it later. She says, no, it's men. It's because those are the areas where women have resources to get out. And so they don't have to kill their way out. I was like blown away by that, right? And even there was another woman who worked in the White House under the Obama administration, Lynn Rosenthal, who said the same thing, who said, you know, in some ways men have been the greatest beneficiary from the women's movement. They have closer relationships with their kids. They die of you know, homicides in lesser numbers. And I was like just blown away by that. And what that tells us, the reduction in male homicide rates, is that women have whatever community resources are available to them. Maybe it's money, maybe it's better family resources, maybe it's church, maybe it's, you know, shelters that are more like transitional homes for them that are longer term than shelters, whatever it is. But those who are in prison, and it's a huge number. In fact, it's not tracked nationally, so only certain states track it. I think New York actually might be one of them. But it's well over half the women in prison. And researchers will say there are women who are violent, but women are more often violent in response to men's violence. It's a retaliatory violence.
So let us go back to your conversation with Ms. DeBuse and of her work and this idea of predicting and understanding and ultimately then preventing domestic violence.
Yeah, and can I just say kudos to pronouncing that name right? No one ever gets their last name. I've heard them talk about that for years.
He's yelled at me enough times, I know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I just want to say as an aside, his book, his most recent novel, Gone So Long,
yes,
is about a domestic violence homicide written from the perspective of the man who killed his wife and is now trying to make amends with the daughter, you know, many decades later. And it's fascinating because, you know, he's coming at it from a fictional perspective, I'm coming at it from a journalistic perspective, and his sister is coming at it from, you know, boots on the ground perspective. Suzanne DeBuse is, she's a powerhouse. She, of course, has her own story of domestic violence in her first marriage when she's in her 20s, and I think that really gave her insight into how isolated victims can be and how what it takes to get them out. But she had been running the Jeannie Geiger Crisis Center out of Newburyport for years when a woman named Dorothy Gunta Cotter came to them and was just instantly, it was obvious she was in a volatile situation, so much so that she said, he's going to kill me. I know he's going to kill me. He knows where all the shelters are. There's no point in me going to shelter. And indeed, she sort of did predict her own death. She was killed while the police were there, while the 911 operator was on the phone with her 11-year-old daughter. And you could hear in that moment, in that entire recorded call, like the anatomy of a domestic violence homicide scene. And Suzanne talks about this a lot, how it devastated the community, but it just really devastated them because they thought, if we can't protect the most vulnerable in our line of work, what are we doing? What are we doing if we can't protect the Dorothys? So they really did a lot of soul searching, and they went back and they got together and they looked at the research and they tried to figure out where the gaps in their system were, and they created a whole new way of looking at domestic violence homicide through the lens of like these risk indicators. And it's really revolutionized how we are able to look at the possibility of a domestic violence homicide in any given situation. She's just a champion.
You immerse us in the book with stories and facts and programs and ideas and thoughts and things to ponder and things to wring our hands over. What would you like the takeaway to be ultimately?
That domestic violence is not a social ill that is any different from homelessness, poverty, racial and gendered, systematized institutional issues. That it is something, in fact, that we can make a difference in, and that we need to be unafraid to ask questions. I think that's really the takeaway.
Do you see room for optimism of improvement?
I actually do, and I'm not just saying this because, you know, I have this book out, but I do, and it's partly because there was a researcher in New York named James Gilligan who told me years ago, he said, you know, you look at any moment of vast social upheaval, at least in contemporary history in this country, you know, the union movement, the suffrage movement, the civil rights movement, and all of those movements were so, so difficult in the moment, but progress won out. Progressivism won out. Social change won out in those moments. And that actually gives me a lot of hope, right? That we're looking at an age of mass shootings and mass incarcerations, and those things all intersect with domestic violence. And I feel like this book, my book, talks about the origins of things like that. And just the fact that we're having this conversation, that you and I are having this conversation, does actually give me hope.
Well, the name of the book is No Visible Bruises: What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. The book is published by Bloomsbury. Rachel Louise Snyder, what a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you so much for being with us and sharing your important work.
Oh, thank you. The pleasure was entirely mine.
Again, the name of the book is No Visible Bruises: What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Rachel Louise Snyder is the author. The book is published by Bloomsbury. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.